Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
I was sitting in a petrol station last night and I was commenting, and mother of God, the window got tapped 3 times in 10 minutes. They are
that
mad.
Was the one lad.
Yeah. they're mental about it, yeah.
That's don't go to rock.
Subscribe to the OTBGAA podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. OTBGAA.
Welcome to the Mike Quirk Podcast.
Now give me my theme music.
This series is brought to you with the help of PST Sport. PST Sport is a design and build specialist contractor focusing exclusively on the design and construction of artificial grass pitches and supporting infrastructure for soccer, GAA, rugby, hockey and tennis. PST's portfolio includes over 50 FIFA certified artificial grass pitches, as well as multiple pitches tested and approved for World Rugby, GAA and FIH standards. PST Sports have done over 500 artificial grass pitches for clubs, schools, colleges and local authorities in Ireland and the UK for all different sporting codes. Visit pstsport.com for more details. Okay, welcome again, everybody. I suppose last week was our first one of the second series, and this time I'm delighted to welcome Fionn Fitzgerald. I suppose he'll be best known to people from his role, his days playing with Kerry, captaining Kerry to the last All-Ireland before this one in 2014. Obviously, a Dr. Crokes man below in Kerry and has won plenty with them and is now a lecturer in MTU Kerry, working in the Health and Leisure Department. So, Fionn, great to have you on, man. Delighted to be able to talk to you.
Thanks, Mike. Nice initiative too as well. I really I like the connection with a charity as well. So hopefully, obviously, coaches can benefit out from it, but and parents as well. But also that there's a few bob in earned as well. So
yeah, for sure. So and I would have said that, you know, last week, and I'll say it again at the end of this one, lads, that is the two kind of dual purposes, I suppose. One, we definitely want to provide some good content for coaches, and hopefully that we can improve what they're doing. Sort of the kids are getting a little bit more out of it, but also as Fionn mentioned, there's a charity element to it and a fundraising element, which I'm trying to raise a few quid for Recovery Haven in Tralee, who are an organization who provide free cancer support services for the people of Kerry. So again, like I would have said last week, if you do find value in the episodes, then it would be great, obviously, to find a link in the podcast description below or on my Twitter page at Mike Quirk and throw a couple of euros in there. It's all going to a very, very worthy cause, to be fair. So Fionn, just I suppose to as a little bit of context to get started, man, your playing days, obviously we're not going to spend, you know, too much time because this is about maybe the research that you're looking at and how fascinating that is from a coaching point of view. But was your research in any way informed by your playing days or your experiences as a youngster?
It certainly was, Mike, I think, yeah. Ultimately, I suppose the type of stuff I am researching, which we'll probably talk about a little bit more soon, is I can trace a lot of and relate a lot of this back to maybe my own underage career, not just in football, but in other sports as well. So I think it's the curiosity from playing and as I got older and then obviously studying different areas and different parts, I suppose, kind of brought about this really, essentially. Yeah. So it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. So I suppose for people that aren't aware of you, you're also a PhD candidate and you're looking, your research is particularly around the age of, or the kind of topics of biobanding and relative age effect and the physical maturation rates. Now for most under sevens, nines, tens, 15 coaches, that doesn't sound like it means a whole pile. So maybe you could give us a kind of an overview of what it is you're looking at really in a research context.
Okay, so basically, like previously at undergrad level and masters, I had looked at relative age effect, which essentially some would be aware of it. A lot of parents, when you discuss it, or coaches will be familiar. So the idea of when a player is born. So for example, Johnny is born in January, and in a under 14 age group, there's someone else born maybe in December. So that whole maybe 11 month difference or 12 month difference that can go on. So that was something I found quite interesting. And we found, obviously, going back maybe 10 years ago or so, that it, similar to a lot of other sports, there was a big, I suppose, bias towards people born earlier in the year, particularly at, we'll say, elite level or selection squads and so on. And that's across the board in sport. So that was one kind of starting point. But what we're kind of looking at a little bit more in detail now is looking at the effects of maturity. So looking at growth and maturity. So maturity is kind of coming from the idea of people developing towards an adult state or so on at different rates or different stages. So for argument's sake, your relative age effect at the under 14 example, you could have anything up to maybe 11 or 12 months difference between Johnny and somebody else. Whereas when we look at maturity, which we kind of found very, very interesting, we're looking at it from the point of view of somebody who could be up to 5 or 6 years of a difference biologically or body-wise. So I suppose a lot of coaches and parents probably can relate to the idea of maybe seeing an underage game in various different sports, whereby you see this massive variance in that. And just a little bit, I suppose, more on the kind of the differences between relative age and maturity, because they kind of get a little bit confused and complicated at times. And it's probably important to kind of differentiate them a little bit, is that like age differences are there from a very young age, so from primary school, and they can transfer along the way right up to business, at adult level and so on, in politics, in various different sporting contexts. Maturity becomes a significant factor around the time of puberty, okay, or the famous growth spurt, and that's something we'll probably chat a little about soon. And that differs in boys and girls. So in girls, you're talking about maybe 12 and a half years of age, in boys around 14 years of age. So essentially what we're looking at in particular was the difference in maturity rates in a boy capacity or in a male perspective. So that's essentially, I don't know if I explained it well enough there, but that's the starting point for where we came at.
Yeah, like that one, you know, that, and everyone had heard that story about the father who the kid was getting born there in the last couple of days of December and bribing the midwife to try and change the date of birth to the 1st of January or something, because, and that's an old wives' tale, obviously, but it's the fact that it's more advantageous if you're born in early January as opposed to born in late December, because it's almost like you're getting an extra year at that age grade, really.
Yeah, statistically speaking, like there's no getting away from that. If you're born earlier in the year, there is a higher chance in a lot of sports, for sure. So that's one end. But as I said, that's already there. And it's like you'll find relative age effects now if you looked at it under 17, or say under 7, under 8, under 9s. Whereas what we've learned from other sports, and something we were interested in looking at in a Gaelic perspective, because it hadn't really been looked at from there, is that maturity biases tend to kick in. You'll see a lot of the English academies, they take age and maturity, they assess them throughout. There's maybe not much of a maturity bias along the way, and then you're coming to maybe under 12, under 13 in boys, and all of a sudden you see this huge bias towards early maturing players. So in other words, they go through this accelerated growth spurt, and there's massive changes that goes on. So there's like for males, there's a huge increase in testosterone. Obviously that's going to lead to increase in muscle mass hugely around that time, and you're going to have maybe differences in the likes of strength, power, speed. It's normally quite obvious to see when you look back on it in hindsight. So there's a lot of anecdotal experience here, but we wanted to kind of delve into it a little bit more and understand. So I'll probably talk a little bit more about some of the effects that we saw, and maybe that's out there in other sports, and see how it can kind of relate back to coaches and parents as well. Like,
Yeah, and that's probably the key thing, is how it does relay back to, you know, coaches and parents. The video I was looking through your presentation there, and we might I'll be able to stick it up and stick up a link to this to the video as well. But the video of the rugby player, I'm not sure where he was from, was obviously some age grade under 12s or 14s or whatever, and you'd probably know where it's from. But and the guy was obviously within the same age grade, and he looked like he was probably about 4 or 5 years younger or older. Excuse me, he looked like John Olomu back in the day, running
exactly
through guys. And that's the maturity or the physical maturity. When you're talking about maturity, are you talking about more the physical than anything else in the context that you're speaking?
Yeah, I probably should explain it a little bit more. So, like, an analogy I use sometimes with coaches is maybe like thinking of a fruit or something like that. So you're looking at maybe something like bananas. So you'd have different levels of bananas in relation to ripeness, that type of idea, or a tomato. Like, someone might have a green tomato versus an extreme red tomato. That type of an idea in relation to maturation is the physical aspect, first of all, that we're looking at. But like, it comes in loads of different forms. So you have dental maturation, sexual maturation, psychosocial maturation. There's loads of different aspects of it, but the physical one is the one which is extremely prominent around peak height velocity, or also known as the growth spurt. So like, you're going to see, if you go to maybe an under 14 or 15 game, you're probably going to see your early maturing players running the show, for want of a better word, in most kind of field sports anyway. So they're going to be physically stronger, they can jump faster, they can run faster, they're running through players. They're normally, as I said, running or bossing the game to an extent. And I'll give you a few examples of that as we go along as well. But so that's kind of the you asked me earlier about, was it informed by my underage career or whatever? It was, because part of this is looking at it from a participation point of view, and part of it's looking at it from a performance point of view. Mm-hmm. From a participation point of view, you're looking at trying to keep everyone playing as long as they possibly can. Mm-hmm. And maturity has a significant effect in both the male and the female population. We're talking maybe 13 to 17 years of age. That's the key. They're the key ages where a lot of people are dropping out.
Yeah.
And there's different changes going on. And then the second part of it is performance wise. So how many superstars that ran the show, for want of a better word, at 13, 14, 15 are struggling when they get to maybe 16, 17, minor level, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
And possibly haven't transferred their so-called potential, which arguably now, when you look back on it or look at it now, may have been skewed from a supporter / parent or coach's point of view by their physical prowess. So maybe they necessarily didn't have the technical or tactical skills or psychological skills, but they were just heavily reliant on their physical skills. So there's two of them. There's the early mature and the late mature. So you're kind of looking at, are you doing the early mature a disservice if you let him run the show, for want of a better word, and be the main guy and I suppose run through the middle and make it into a real physical type of game, and not work on other aspects of the game. And then the late maturing guy, like, he's probably going to need something special to say in the system or to really stick with it at times. So you kind of have to look at it. Do you want to get the best out of both of them? And we'll talk about maybe strategies around that later on. Like.
And so just to make it really, really simple and understandable for people, when you're talking about early maturers, you're talking about those kids that are more physically developed than everybody else at the same age grade. They're the ones that physically dominate games, whether it's basketball or football or soccer, doesn't matter. They're the ones that are dominating and they look like they're a cut above everybody else simply because they're more powerful. Maybe their skills aren't as refined as other people, but their size is such an advantage that they're the ones that really stand out at that age grade. That's when we're talking about, early maturers or early developers, that's really what you're talking about, isn't it?
It is, I suppose. But I suppose I just have to kind of premise this with the fact that, like, not everyone that's advancing their maturity is necessarily very physical. So for argument's sake, like, at under 14, you probably realistically were an early mature, I'd imagine. I probably wasn't. But like, at the end of the day, like, we can kind of predict roughly where they're going to end up. We can estimate where they're going to be at, we'll say final adult height, which is one of the big maturity indices we use. Mm-hmm. And with that in mind, basically, that's kind of where we're coming at from that point of view. So it's not as simple always as just eyeballing and say, oh, the big guys are running the show, they're the early maturers and so on. Because we had a couple of opposite examples of that as well. So that's why I'll talk a little bit more about the actual measuring, getting the players' heights and weights, calculating where they're at based on their parents' information and so on. That's what gives us real information that we can properly work off. Whereas other times maybe you're eyeballing it and so on. But I suppose it is probably relatively fair to suggest that the early maturing guys are in general, the more advanced they're. Yeah.
I was just trying to get my head around it in a simple context. Yeah. And the research then that you're doing that's informing this on a kind of a quantitative level, like you're looking at, and it's not, again, this isn't about development squads. This is just about trying to get a group of people that can give you the results and the numbers that you're looking at. But your research is looking a little bit at development squads and different things there.
Yeah. So basically, like, we wanted to see, right, was there like, so just to kind of set the context once again, like a lot of research has been done in the likes of soccer, so there's very little been done when I say soccer, I'm on about Premier League soccer in particular. There's a lot of work on in around growth and maturation over the last maybe 10 or 15 years in their academy setting, and then there are other sports like rugby maybe has done some research and so on, whereas there's been nothing kind of published on in Gaelic games. And right. I suppose it being the most popular sport in Ireland and be so big in Ireland that, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of these rules are fairly easily applied in different contexts. So we wanted to see, was there a maturation bias at academy level? So we used the Kerry development squads or academy squads, and we used some of the Cork squads. And basically we wanted to see, was there a maturity bias there? And I suppose to look at it, just to answer that mildly, the answer is there was an extremely strong bias towards early maturing players out of, I think, around 250 players that we got players. So players' heights and weights, and along with their parents' heights, were able to predict where they're at in their stage of biological maturation. So in other words, we use their predicted adult height to see if Johnny is at 90% of his predicted right. adult height or 95 and so on. And we found essentially that at under 14, 15, and 16, that maturity biases were very, very significant. There was only one late maturing player out of the 250 players. So it was mainly either early maturing players or players that were on time.
Right. Yeah. That's fairly overwhelming.
Yeah. But I mean, just to give a little bit of context on it, like, that's consistent with what you'll see in the Premier League. So we'll say one of my supervisors, Sean Cumming. So I've three supervisors, two in UL, Mark Campbell, who I've done a lot of my research previously on relative age, and Phil Kearney, a Kerry man actually, who's would be big in researching around the coaching side of things. Basically, Sean, coming from the UK, from University of Bath, he does a lot of work with the Premier League clubs. So we got, like, modeling some of the work that we're doing in Gaelic games and what they've learned over the water. And essentially what they found is something very similar in the likes of Southampton, Arsenal, Bournemouth, a lot of the clubs that he would have been involved with. So it's nothing majorly different. And actually Liam Sweeney, who's doing a PhD in this very similar area to myself, has published recently on the in Irish context, in an FAI scenario. So he's used the Irish soccer teams, and we say the underage teams as well. So quite similar there, really, from the maturity point of view.
Yeah, and understandable, obviously, because these are the fellas that are going to be the best players when you're watching an under 14 game or an under 15 game. These are most of the guys that are going to be dominating those games. So it's obviously easier to get selected or to get picked on these different sides. But therein, I suppose, lies a difficulty for coaches as well, like in terms of, like, you know, how are you going to, and we'll get to it as we go, obviously, but it's about looking after, how do we get those late developers to keep playing, and then to try and make sure that their level is as high as the early developers in a couple of years' time. It's just it's a quandary for those fellas to see how you can get the very best out of them over a long period of time as well, obviously.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because ultimately, like, they're lagging, they can be lagging behind. Like, for example, just to give you a couple of case study examples, we had, like, an example of one development squad where you had a player who was at 100% of his adult height, and he was maybe 95 kilos, so obviously he was a big boy. And then we had someone who was 35 or 36 kilos, and he was at 87% of his adult height. So in other words, like, you had one guy who was, for want of a better word, almost cooked in relation to height wise. He was you know, he had a biological age, so he had a body age, for want of a better word, of 18 years of age. So he was 14 by date of birth, but he was actually 18 from a body perspective. And then this other guy was maybe 12 and a half. So, like, there was almost 6 years of a difference between these two guys, and they were on the same, they're in the same squad. So, like, there's like, going back to your scenario there, it is a bit of a, it's a kind of a tricky one for coaches to to challenge or to manage that. Because in all fairness to the coaches, and we spoke about these players, were that they really saw the potential in the late maturing player. They obviously had to mind him. They were hurt, like, very much trying to keep him in the system. But it was probably easier almost to keep the more advanced maturing guy in the system, because he was able to maybe perform better in games and so on. So, like, the scenario between development and current performance and potential is a tricky one at times, and that's kind of one or two of the other studies we're looking at. Our coaches basically, what are they rating the early maturing guys as the better players, which they have in other sports, versus maybe the later maturing guys, you know.
Yeah, and it's difficult, obviously. That's very hard to predict what a fella is going to turn into. Fiona, you mentioned just growth spurt there earlier, as probably the layman's terms for it. But like, we've all heard of a growth spurt, and, you know, and roughly when it occurs in boys versus girls. What does it mean kind of physically? If you're somebody that's playing basketball or rugby or soccer or Gaelic football, like, what are the things that are happening at that stage that would affect their ability to perform and to play that you know, maybe coaches should be aware of, just to maybe give people a little break and see what's going on?
Yeah, so sometimes it can be maybe obvious for some coaches or parents. They might kind of almost suss it out or figure it out a little bit. But essentially, I'll compare male and females in a second now. And the female population is probably being under researched. It's an area that we're actually quite interested in. And there's a couple of students in MTU that I'm supervising this year who are going to look at it in a female perspective, which I'm really interested to see how that works out. But male-wise, anyway, you're looking at a massive increase in testosterone. Okay, so you're going to have, like, massive kind of growth, basically, all of a sudden. So limbs and extremities, like, are going to grow at different rates, which potentially can lead to, like, clumsiness, loss of coordination. Like, that whole kind of Bambi legs type of idea can be quite common. So normally what happens is they stretch first and then they fill out. So you often hear that about what this guy is after filling out a load in the last 6 months. So normally the peak height velocity, which is the big growth spurt, comes first. And after that, quite soon, within a few months, is peak weight velocity. So you'll see them filling out a lot. Then internally, things like, obviously, all their organs, their hearts, their lungs, they're all increasing in size. But, like, a lot of these occur at different rates and different times. So there's a lot of changes going on in the body. And I suppose the risk of injury is increased an awful lot. There can be a huge increase in strength and endurance, but it doesn't necessarily always translate to good performance straight away. So that might, if I'm saying to you that everyone's increasing testosterone, your first kind of thing might be, sure, that's brilliant. It does, when it levels out, it's normally quite good. But what some of the research suggests, so some of Sean's previous PhD students and Megan Hill, looked at coach perceptions and found basically in Southampton that from assessing their maturation over a few years, that players going through their growth spurt, coaches actually rated them significantly less on their match grades during those periods of time, right, and without necessarily knowing. So in other words, they probably weren't performing as well. Yeah. And that wasn't necessarily, the coach didn't necessarily know what was going on, maybe. But so that's one aspect which is really, really important, I think, to note, especially when we're talking about your under 14, 15 level kind of a thing. Another one is the injury risk. David Chanson, who's at Bournemouth and now at West Ham, he's done some lovely research on tracking over a number of years a lot of the academy players. And basically what he found was players going through their growth spurt had a massive, there was a massive spike in injuries. So growth-related injuries. Things like maybe your Asger Schlaters, your Severs injuries, a lot of these type of injuries that are related or connected with growth are huge around then. And the second thing, actually, interestingly, was, which we might talk about towards the end, and solutions to some of this, is they actually ran an intervention then where they pulled some of these players and they reduced their training load a little bit while going through the growth spurt, which didn't really have a huge difference on how they performed or anything, but ultimately their risk of injury or the injury rates decreased significantly. So in other words, like, training everyone at the same level while some are gone through the growth spurt is probably a little bit unfair on those who are in the middle of it, if that makes sense. And then the flip side of it is the female population. So, like, what you see a lot, particularly at schools level and, you know, in sports all over the country, would be that males and females play together a lot, up to maybe 11, 12 years of age.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why it tends to drift away a little bit at times is because when they go through puberty, very different changes occur. So females estrogen obviously would be the big hormone there that would accelerate. And essentially their kind of hips widen, they potentially increase their body fat and so on. So the changes that occur in a female are a bit different than a male, and that has an effect on things like strength, speed, power. So funnily enough, in some sports you may actually see an increase in late maturing players from puberty basically, as opposed to early maturing, because some of the effects of growth spurt maybe cause them to decrease in some of the stuff I was on about there.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Okay. Yeah. And like, I just made a note there, man, of like growth, your growth spurt really, you know, will probably lead to a decrease in performance. Is that too wide a statement just based on what you were quoting there?
No, I don't think it's totally true, but I would say it's different for everyone. Okay.
Okay.
I suppose the most important thing would be to that, like a very simple message for coaches would be, if you're seeing a rapid enough decrease in performance,
right,
it should be a consideration. Gotcha. And factor that in with the likes of, like, let's just say a male, for example, if you see a guy all of a sudden like shooting up, and then all of a sudden, I don't know, hair all over, facial hair, and filling out a lot of the signs that we probably associate with puberty, like you're probably very likely looking at that. Like physios, that if they're coming to physios with niggles and stuff at times, those kind of, a lot of those we'll say signs can lead to maybe understanding a little bit more about it. But it's actually very easily understood if you're actually measuring it, which is what I would have spoken about earlier. Like,
and again, just to repeat it, so you're talking about girls kind of from around 12 and a half.
Yeah, around 12-ish maybe, and males then closer to 14.
Okay.
So they basically, females go through it, go through menarche earlier and stuff like that, whereas male, and obviously we know that, like, sexual maturation wise, that it's very different that goes on in the male and female body. So that all has an effect in relation to performance.
Like, yeah, it's just interesting, like, that those ages obviously are the ages that a lot of, you know, like, you're getting a lot of people dropping out of sport, obviously, at those different ages as well. So it's something that coaches, obviously, they've got so much to do, man, preparing sessions and making sure they get kids in the field. And it's just something to be aware of that is obviously has a dramatic effect on people of 14, 15, 16 or younger for girls. It's a huge time in their lives, obviously, physically, that maybe we're not as conscious of as we probably should be.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in the female population, particularly, like, there's obviously a huge link with, like, body image and the changes that go on there from puberty. So I think that's also an important consideration. But I think that conversation is in a better place now. And I think there's a lot, like, there's a huge momentum behind what's going on. But just, I suppose, to explain to coaches that, obviously, first of all, boys and girls aren't mini adults, which a lot of the time people might think. And the second part of it is that boys and girls, and anyone who has sons and daughters, will probably be able to understand that better than anyone.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You spoke about measuring it or monitoring it, and obviously not every club or underage coach is going to have the ability to actually measure this and actually track it and see where kids are along that kind of predicted growth. What kind of mechanisms are you using, or what are you looking at with the squads and different things to track that?
Okay, so, like, basically the gold standard for this is what we call, like, you're looking at skeletal age, which we'll say some of the Premier League clubs might have it, or the ones that are really advanced, where you take a wrist x-ray, and based off the reading the bone scenario there, the bone growth, you can estimate exactly where they're at. So my quirk is 14 years of age, but biologically he's coming in at 15 and a half. So he's, you know, that kind of a scenario. Right.
Yeah.
But we use a non-invasive one, which is basically we take the player's height and weight, and then we basically get their parents, both their parents' heights and their estimated parents' heights, sorry, their self-reported. So they would fill out, like, say, an online form, and we can kind of manipulate that a little bit to allow for parents who might overestimate or underestimate their own height based on him and Johnny or whoever. So that's how we use it. And I'm happy to share any of that kind of those formulas we use and so on. It's relatively straightforward and kind of organized from that point of view. But like, even away from using that, I think the parents' perspective brings the genetic component into it. So one part I haven't probably alluded to too much is that, like, they say about 80% of maturation is connected with genetics. Okay. So essentially, both relative age wise, as you said, when parents are given out to the midwife about when the child is born, so the relative age one and the biological maturation scenario, they're both very much connected to parents. So you like, I often make the joke to kids, you can blame your parents for nearly everything. So that's kind of another factor in relation to that as well. But even tracking height and weight, like, you don't need to be a rocket scientist or you don't need to be any crazy scientist from that perspective. Tracking height and weight over a period of time, like, that's just growth rate, like, very simply. And if you're seeing rapid enough increases, so normally we're looking at it maybe every 3 months or 6 months, anything at all to track it at all is quite useful. But I don't know, is that answering your question? Like, I can talk about maturation or sorry about measuring as long as you want there, but it you can eyeball it, but you'd want to be a lot more experienced in understanding maturity, and like, I'm only scratching the surface on it today. Yeah. You know, like, but the most accurate way without a doubt is measuring. And that allows you to inform it, because I'll give you examples, like in the development squads, and we let's say we assessed 250 players and we looked at them over the last maybe 2 years, you're going to see players who are actually, we'll say, at 99% of their predicted adult height. So they're almost at their adult height at maybe 14 or 15, but they may not necessarily be the tallest players in the team at all. And you might have guys who are really tall at the latter stage or down in the on time or later maturing stage. And they actually may have a huge potential for growth yet.
Yeah.
So like it's a bit naive to say just big and small. People might talk about it in that language, like, but
you can blame mom and dad again for that, like.
Very much part of a lot of it, absolutely.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I like that presentation I was watching, Des Ryan was speaking about, was it Ballincollig or a club in Cork that were looking at doing this themselves as well and kind of keeping track of it?
Yeah, exactly. Very similarly, Ian Jones, he was out in America for a couple of years and he's come back and he's doing great work down there. And basically, very similar to our own, they looked at it from a club level. I suppose, like, Bicham Sound, from my understanding, would be a big enough club. But they would have found similar enough, probably not as strong in effect, but I mean, that at a club level, it was still quite significant. So in other words, there was maturity biases were present there at in a club context, which is really, really interesting. And I think that's an area that would warrant, like, I've looked at kind of potentially maybe doing a bit of research at club level at different grades almost. So you might have a Division 1 under 14 team and a Division 5 under 14 team, and seeing what the differences occur there. I think that would be a quite cool area to look at. But once again, like, without even going down the research route, very easy for clubs to do a lot of this as well if they're interested. It's the club level is the interesting one, because we know that, like we'll say, as you spoke about development squads earlier, they're still only involved for a short period of time in the season. So it's the schools and the clubs. I think the schools have a key role as well. The clubs and schools, to me, are the really, really important one. And actually did a coach education kind of workshop there a couple of weeks ago with club coaches, and the feedback was super. Really, really interested. They were really engaged and they had some really good questions. So, like, one of the things that came out of the development squad interviews and focus groups with coaches afterwards around the results, they were extremely open to a lot of this. They wanted more knowledge they wanted more information on this. They literally were really into this. But one of the things that they said was potentially that the selection biases are already fed or are connected with club coaches in some way, because often club coaches send their three or four best players to the trials. And then you have your three or four best players and you've, I don't know, 100 players maybe in trials or whatever it is over a period of time. But what we love to look at is actually the players that are coming to the trials. I suspect that maybe the pool of players coming into the trials is already potentially biased towards early maturing players, which is started by the club players, because, you know, inevitably your club coach sends his three or four best players who possibly are the guys who are the early maturing guys and running the show, for want of a better word, like, you know. So
you,
basically what it looks like, Mike, in this, from what we've seen in this, is that, and similar to soccer and other sports, that you need to be extremely you need to be really good and really determined, and you need to have something special if you're a late maturing player. Okay. Yeah. Or you need to have coaches who are really open to keeping the net wide and so on. And in fairness to coaches, when we kind of showed some of this information back to them, we'll say the second year there was a lot of kind of, you know, a lot of interest in it from their end, and they were definitely thinking about it a little bit differently, which was interesting. Like, and they were
And look, like you're not breaking any serious news there, saying if you're an early maturer, you are advantaged in terms of being selected for these squads and different things. But like, what would be very interesting is to see how many of those guys, you know, are still there 10 or 15 years later, playing at senior inter-county level or playing international sport at whatever their chosen field is. And like, did the challenges that they were facing meet, you know, what they needed at that time? It's obviously, there is no answer yet, obviously, but it would be fascinating to look at that on a really long-term kind of a thing, because like, for coaches, listen to this now, and like, yeah, if you're a guy who's a late mature, you're not as strong as the rest of them, how do we keep them playing, and how do we keep them engaged? Like that research that I mentioned there from Des or Ryan or whoever carried it out in Bishopstown, there was two of
them.
There was two of the age groups, two of the older age groups had zero, if I'm remembering correctly, had zero late maturers in their like 15s and 17s age brackets or something like that. So zero boys who were late maturers were still playing football for that club, or maybe it was hurling and football by the time they were 15 and 17. Like that would be a problem, obviously, for us looking at that as coaches.
100%, yeah, absolutely. And that's a question I don't have the answer to straight out. We need to look at that a little bit more. But it looks like, well, to me, it looks like potentially that when puberty kicks in, particularly that, and especially with teams where there's more of a pick, you know what I mean, where there's a bigger selection pick, that coaches potentially are biasing those players who are early maturing or on time, you know, not the late maturing guys anyway. And as a result, they're being squeezed out, or maybe they go off into other sports, which would be great if that was the case. But like, I think maybe the dropout research suggests maybe not. They're potentially slipping away and going off elsewhere. So I can't answer that fully, but I suppose you'd be kind of anecdotally suggesting that might be the case. Just on that, actually, Rob Mulcahy, who's from Tralee, he's worked with Clare, but he's doing a PhD on that transition rate, which is going to be quite interesting. So in the next few years, I think he'll have some good stuff out on that. But the idea of tracking youth, we'll say, success to senior level, so from a development squad point of view. And basically, I don't think there's anything being done really in a GA or Irish context too much, as far as I know anyway, in GA context. But in other sports, it tends to be quite poor. So in other words, the potential superstars basically at youth level, their conversion to senior level is I don't think the statistics are too high on what happens there. So that's like, that'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, that would be fascinating, because we've all anecdotally, like, we've all seen the guys that are dominant at under 12s and under 14s, and suddenly they start to dwindle away a little bit. And it is those guys maybe who are late developers, who nobody thought much of at under 12s or 14s, suddenly are the guys that are, you know, carrying the show at senior or beyond, you know, which would be interesting.
Not that we go into this debate about minor or anything, but like, the more I look at this as time goes along, it actually adds another layer of intrigue or importance, I think, to the idea of maybe exploring the under 18 bracket idea again, because ultimately, if you're cutting it off at under 17, you're nearly making it easier again for players to drop out, particularly because maturity, it's normally starting to kind of ease off a little bit around then, but it's easing off even more again at 18s. Whereas if the cloth has been cut at 17s, almost not cut, but that there's another gap between that and 19. So I think the maturity factor is actually something that should come into the debate around this as well, you know.
Yeah, like, and even again, like, the minor, Kerry minor management of the previous James Costello and the lads that were involved, they obviously would have had two teams undergo due to COVID from a bunch of 17s and then the guys that were left over for a following year, there were 18s. And the difference physically that, you know, between the 17s and the 18s was just incomparable, that, you know, they'd say in that 1 year alone, you know?
Yeah.
So it is huge. That is obviously huge. And then, like, so we're aware, obviously, that this is a problem, and you're now gathering the evidence to suggest that this is an issue for us. What are some of the solutions? Like, I mentioned biobanding and stuff at the start. Most people, I didn't really have much of an idea of what it was. Can you give us a bit of an idea of what that concept is about, really, Fionn?
Okay, so basically biobanding is something that has been done particularly in soccer. It's been done in a number of other sports, but it's grouping players on their stage or on biological maturity as opposed to their actual chronological age. So in very simple terms, we're both under 14. We play normally as we do under 14 in our age group, but in a biobanded fashion, you might be mixed with a guy who's under 16. Because you're physically more advanced, or so you're working at his level, and he might be a little bit less advanced. So what we looked at in Kerry capacity, so there's a number of different studies, and like it's going to take a few years to get a lot. I'm sitting on a lot of data, so to get a lot of this information out. But the boy bending was a really interesting project we ran this year for maybe about a month in Kerry, and with two of the squads, the under 14s, we broke up players into two different bands. So basically we worked from 95% of adult height, sorry, from 88 to 93% of adult height, and from 94% upwards. So that might sound a little bit mathsy and sciencey. It's very, very simple and straightforward. We had all this information from collecting their heights and weights and the parents' information, and we were able to put them into kind of, we call it the first group, the 94 plus, or a more advanced group. They're the more mature group. They're closer to their final adult height. Mm-hmm. So they're more cooked, for want of a better word.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the other ones have a good bit more potential for growth. So we broke them into those, and we did for a couple of weeks, we did a little bit of small-sided games and training, and we trained in those little groups, and we kind of wanted to see how that would work out. So that was one part. And then what we finished with, we played some 15-a-side games. So they normally would play each other in games, we'll say Kerry North and Kerry South, whereas we did it this way, we did it actually in a 15-a-side, we call it less mature game, and a more okay, advanced maturity game. And like they're I suppose we realistically, I knew what came out of it in soccer, but we didn't really know what was going to come out of it here. It wasn't a shot in the dark, but it was almost to see how this would unfold. But it was extremely interesting what happened, because we got players and coaches feedback. There was also two students, John Blake from Kerry was looking at it from a technical perspective and tactical. So videoing the games and seeing what differences from that and normal games, was there any differences in that? And then another student, Hugh from Cork, was actually looking at it, Hugh O'Neill, in a psychosocial perspective. So they would have done some psychosocial questionnaires before and after. But the interesting part, I suppose, was what we got from players and coaches around that. So I don't know, do you want to kind of go into the findings or what we found there?
Yeah, sure.
So basically, players loved it, by and large. I mean, we had our late maturing and we'll call them our early maturing players. I mean, calling them late maturing, but there's no late maturing players in the system. They're the less mature, we call them.
Right.
So the first of all, the late maturing guys said, this is brilliant. So essentially, like, normally I'm playing corner forward and I don't get any ball in the game. And if I do, I can't, all the big guys are running the show, and basically I can't really do what I was able to do today. So I was able to take on men. The link play between our games is brilliant. So like there was a number of teams that kind of came out, and this is just very anecdotal at the moment, because I need to completely go through it from an analysis point of view. But like skill wise there was a noticeable difference in skill in the late maturing game, so I suppose there was an awful lot more passing, interlink play, communication with those players. The physical aspect was taken out of the game. So in other words, it was at a way more appropriate and mature level. So everyone was like, I'm marking a guy who's kind of at my own level or my own grade. So there are some of the kind of ideas from their perspective, and they just found it a really positive experience. They're like, it actually arms me more now when I go back training with the full group next week. I feel more confident, and I definitely kind of, it's made me think that way. The early maturing players and the opposite end, who are normally the big guys that were mm-hmm. controlling the game, they found it really, really, really difficult. Some of the kind of quotes were like, I haven't played in as hard a game in I don't know how long. I couldn't run through the middle anymore. Every time I got the ball, there was someone on me. Mm-hmm. Like I couldn't kick the ball. Like, so this kind of an side of the thing. So the physical aspect was one. Then they were finding it like tactically that they were struggling a little bit more at times. And this is not everyone, anyone, but it's just a kind of as a general, the feedback yeah. from maybe talking to maybe 8 to 10 of these players from either group. And they were agreeing with each other. Like for 13-year-olds, they're extremely articulate. It was probably my favorite part of the PhD so far, where I'll talk about the coaches in a second, but getting their viewpoint, and they knew very little about this. They just, for all the world, they thought they were playing normal games. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was the kind of stuff that came out of it. And then I thought they might be a little bit negative about it, because obviously this is something different and they're not able to be the star of the show. And mm-hmm. they said, no, this makes me kind of think about my game now when I go back next week and have to change it a little bit. But interestingly enough, before that, they had both played normal games. So the normal traditional under 14 games, you'll say a few weeks previous to that. And I got both teams, and rather than their names, I took out their names and I put their percentage of adult height in. And what we found was basically, which isn't surprising, all of the most physically or the most mature players were all down the middle. So your fullback, your centre back, your midfielders, they were all the most mature guys. Whereas that's the thing about biobanding, it took a lot of this out. So they were all in different positions that they weren't able to kind of maybe be as central or dominating from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing was coaches, which is probably the aim of my PhD at the start, was all around coaches. Because when I've spoken a lot about this maturity idea today, and ultimately players have very little control over what goes on in relation to selection of teams, making a team and all. Yeah, of course you can say they need to play well and to make it, but coaches are the deciding factors and all this. So I wanted to see, could we support them in any way? They really enjoyed it. So like right. coaches who had maybe found guys originally who they maybe thought may not be up to the standard or were struggling a lot, they really excelled. They saw them from a different light in the kind of late maturing group, we'll say. And then from a biobanding group, the more advanced guys, they found the players found it going a lot tougher. And coaches saw it from a different angle too. So they actually, some of them, like in the second half of those games, were given specific instructions. Okay. Not trying to solo the ball, for example. Right. You know, so just nothing, very, very simple, straightforward stuff. So essentially, like in case anyone's confused here, it was just normal football games. They were just put in a more mature, appropriate environment. And it just allowed the players to experience something different and a different challenge, a more appropriate challenge. And it allowed the coaches to maybe, you know, reorientate their viewpoint a little bit on players and to see them from a different light. And then they went back in training like normal the following weeks. But after that, when I went away for a few weeks, coaches still used the biobanding quite a bit at times in drills, for example. And they use it in their own kind of creative ways. But yeah, so there's definitely potential there for sure. Like, this is very early days just to trial it out. But like, it sounded like a lot of work before we started it, but it wasn't when we got into it. And I think both benefited, both players and coaches. So it was a positive experience anyway, yeah.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Now, it does sound like for I'm thinking of club people now who are looking at this, and obviously you're speaking about a GA context, but this is those 14-year-olds are playing basketball and they're playing soccer and they're playing everything just the same as they are in the GA. But I'm just thinking of like how that would work to the benefit of those players. Like if I'm the guy who is the early mature, I'm more physically developed and and I'm playing in a game at centre back or midfield and I'm dominating that game, and now suddenly I'm maybe playing against a guy, now I'm 14, and now suddenly I'm playing against a guy maybe who's 16, who's not as physically developed, but is a match for me. No, that's a completely different challenge for my game, and I have to try and improve. That's going to improve me as a player because I'm playing against somebody who's a physical match, and I've got to develop my game a little bit more. And the same on the other side for the fellas who struggle maybe physically with the guys that they're marking against. Now they have a chance to play ball and to play guys that are at their level as well. It makes sense, obviously, yeah?
100%. And like, I suppose some of the kind of considerations previously are like, is this all just based on physical? People have asked, like, can you bend on psychological maturation, all that side of it. But I mean, they're actually getting an alternative psychological challenge by doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So like, let's say they're not being psychologically challenged, for example, for the early maturing guys in their normal age groups, they're probably getting a serious psychological testing.
Mm.
And some people might say it might be too harsh at times, but you're giving a little bit of both. Whereas the late maturing guy who's probably day in, day out, week in, week out, getting this challenge, if we want to call it that, he's now finding it going, you know, a little bit easier. And it's good for his confidence that he's able to kind of, we'll say, you know, expand out a little bit his game and do things that he normally can't do. Like, so that, yeah. So it's interesting from both ends. And just, I suppose, the point to make, and it's not about like changing the game into this all biobend or anything. This is something that's used as a kind of an alternative tool every so often. So like for me, it was like maybe once a month, I think going forward would be a really useful tool for players and coaches. And that's the way they use it in England as well. In the Premier League scenario, they might do like 1 week every month where they drip feed some biobending work, and they do it in the gym as well, and they do it at different levels. So that's another area that something that I'm kind of interested in myself on a side note to look at, maybe the physical development from more a maturity perspective, as opposed to generic, like everyone does the same thing, which is ridiculous. If you give the scenario I had earlier of like one guy who's biological age of 18 and one guy who's 12 and a half and they're in the same team,
yeah.
you're comparing a grown man with a child, basically.
Yeah.
So that's important.
And thinking about it there, Fionn, like, you know, we all probably would have done at different stages. If you were playing, you know, if you were on the age at under 14, you probably would have played with the under, you know, 16 Bs or the, you know, under 16 team if you had it yourself. Like, I mean, there has been kind of conflicting reports that's something that clubs should do or clubs shouldn't do. But like really, like listening to the stuff here, there isn't really a whole pile of, no, I know there's different circumstances in terms of maybe if people aren't ready for that, but if people are ready for that physically, there probably isn't a whole pile wrong with doing that.
No. Like, I mean, like just give an example, let's say, and I can just think, and you can as well, and everyone I'd say even listening can probably relate to this. You can think of players like at 14, 15, those kind of, we call it the growth spurt ages, you know, those typical ones. Like guys who are way more advanced, who are running the show at those age groups at a particular age, like what challenge are they getting? Do you know what I mean? Like what benefit it is for them being like midfield and, you know, plowing through the middle and running the show there. So I think it's good for them. I suppose the only thing I would add to this, which is another opening can of worms, is that if it's done in the right way, like so that they're not training loads of extra. The problem, I suppose, in the past with these superstar guys is that they've been doing this, playing at all the other age groups, but they've been doing everything. So they've been flogged. And that's where they come to 18 and their bodies are absolutely goosed, or they get to 20 or whatever. And that would be the one kind of proviso. So I'd be all for the idea of playing up or playing down. And I think it's a really simple strategy to employ by clubs or by coaches at club level. But it has to be done that you're not adding a significant more training load to it. Like,
But
done smartly, very well. Like, yeah. Once it's done smartly, I think it's an absolute no-brainer, to be honest.
Yeah. And like, it's almost like, I suppose it's biobanding without knowing exactly what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's been going on for years and years and years. Once, like you said, the kid isn't getting flogged, it's probably a very positive thing for their development to go up and get a taste of dealing with those kids in that other age group physically and obviously the pace of the game and different things as well.
I think so. And like, as you said, even other aspects like tactical awareness, the kind of leadership skills, the communication, the kind of psychological skills that, like, so they might have the body of an 18-year-old, but they might have the mind of a, you know, so it's looking at it from different levels. And it might be that sometimes you might feel that a guy actually isn't physically huge, but actually it might be good from a psychological challenge perspective as well. So like I think you can be fluid enough on how you do this, but I suppose what we're talking about in general here is maturity and different rates and looking at kind of optimal challenges at different stages. So we're not saying get rid of age groups or anything like that, because that would just, that's not the scenario, but it's to kind of like doing the same thing over and over again for the same age groups is probably, it's probably not really that beneficial for you or for the player really, like, you know.
And it's, look, I think this whole area is fascinating, and I like we've all been kind of aware of these kind of scenarios, but it's just, it's nice to have, it's nice to have some kind of you know, quantitative data that somebody is looking at to really back it up and some research. But for coaches then, Fionn, like I'm conscious now that people are listening here and they're saying, okay, well, how does this impact me? Or if I'm somebody that's coaching in this age group, like how can I help my players, or how can I help my club to make sure that these guys who are maybe not as developed as everybody else as quickly, how can I keep them playing? How can I challenge the guys who are the early developers? What can I do from this conversation? What can I do that'll help them moving forward?
Yeah, like that's kind of a how long is a piece of string question, but I suppose basically, right, the gist of it, I would say is that, like, if you're not acknowledging this kind of whole concept of growth and maturation whilst working with this cohort of players or that those kind of age groups, you're potentially doing a big disservice to those players. So like you're like it is a significant factor. Not with every player, it can be different, and like that's why everyone is different. But I suppose if you're, you know, going along the idea of a player centered approach, okay, very much individual centered, and that's the kind of idea of modern good coaching and so on, this has to be factored in. So thinking long term, Mike, is probably one of the big ones, really. Like if you can measure, obviously that's fantastic. But without that, having a little bit of an understanding of the area, maybe upskilling a little bit more, hopefully, like I'll get a lot more of this information out over the next few years. But I think you need to think long term. Okay, you need, like, rather than short term. And that's the problem, I think, with a lot of the even professional sports across the water. Like effectively, scouts are still picking the most early mature, sorry, picking early maturing players, and they're still having the same problems with all the money and resources and so on they have. So it's like, look, it's the, I suppose we have a kind of a bias naturally enough towards someone who's performing on any given day. And that's the big one, I suppose. Like I actually use a slide at times where the picture of the iceberg and the underneath the iceberg and the top of the iceberg, and kind of what you see at the outside is probably only a small part. And that's the performance part. Underneath is what's going on over the next couple of years, or what's going on in the body from a biological age perspective. So like that's the one I use with coaches a lot, like knowing about where the player is at in their stage of maturity can definitely help you that way. I probably have gone slightly off on tangent there, but like how can this help coaches? I would say acknowledging kind of the effect of growth and maturation for sure.
Yeah.
And realizing that maturity will wear off. It's for a couple of years. It's like it varies, but like it's going to be maybe roughly from maybe 13 to 16 are going to be the big ages for that. But that is where we lose a lot of players as well.
Mm-hmm.
So like trying to keep them involved, like there's two scenarios here that we've kind of talked a little bit about. We've talked about club players and participation and all, which is ultimately the aim of the game for keeping as many involved as possible. But the other aspect then is performance. So in other words, talented players who you're looking at maybe playing with their county or playing whatever other sport it is at a very high level. Well, like you need to be able to challenge those players accordingly along the way as well. So you've two different kind of types of people to try and keep happy there, like. But I don't know, is that answering it kind of well enough, or do you want to?
Yeah, no. I'm conscious of the guys, like, you know, Donaghy. Like I don't think Kieran would have played football at a very high level at your 12 or 14s. Now he was still probably a bigger kid, but I'm just trying to think of these kind of fellas. I'm very conscious that, like you said it there, we don't know at 13 or 14 or 15 who are the guys that are going to play with your club at senior level, and certainly don't know the guys that are going to play at intercounty or are going to play international basketball or international rugby. We just don't know. You can have a fair idea, and you can be looking at the kids that are dominant in that age group, but realistically, from what you're telling us, we really don't know until everybody's maturation rate evens out and we get an even picture of looking at everybody. Then that's when the, you know, so 16 years of age, 17 years, that's when we'll actually have a better idea, really, as opposed to looking at Johnny at 13 or 14 saying, this guy is going to bring us all the way to wherever.
Yeah, like as you said there, like it's still very hard to predict. And I try to do this with some of the coaches about like who at 16 who might make it to senior level. And it's still so hard to predict, as you said. But like as they go a little bit, as they get goes a little bit more down the pathway, you have a better chance of predicting. But at 13, 14, like I my big advice would be just be really careful as regards selecting. Keep it wide, keep everyone like consider or realize that this is probably going to be a big factor for some of them, okay? And it's going to have an effect on their performance, like even how you deal with players in those scenarios. Do you give the early maturing guys a different challenge? Do you get them to, even if they're still playing in their normal age groups, do you get them to, I don't know, use less plays, put them in a different position, challenge them like a little bit differently from that point of view? And, you know, coax and keep those late maturing guys involved as best you can. I think I'm going to, even another few years, have this conversation with you. I think I'd probably be able to even answer that a little bit better now. But like there's no silver bullet answer to be straight out about it. Like, you know, you have to use your own, like the biggest message, I suppose, is to be very much based, to have very much a kind of a long-term development type of a philosophy. If you have that, I think then that you're going to allow for variation in maturity levels. Whereas if you're about, you know, the next game and today and tomorrow, then you, like that's where a lot of the problems occur at these age groups, like, you know.
Yeah. And like you just said there, like roughly between 13 and 16, like if we're involved in coaching kids at that, between those age groups, we just don't, we don't know, obviously, if we're tracking their height and different things, and we have an idea, but we just don't know where they are in terms of that kind of growth spurt there. So it's probably just so important, obviously, to have an awareness of it. And if we can just keep those kids playing as long as we possibly can, because we have no idea that uncoordinated kid who is, you know, struggling to solo or struggling to shoot the ball or struggling to make a pass or a catch, whatever it might be. If we can just keep them engaged and keep them going and improving, you just don't know when that thing levels out at 15 and 16 years of age, how good that person can be if they stay at the game. And that's probably, it's definitely, you know, it is an area that we're losing a lot of players. There's no question about that. And it's something obviously that coaches need to be more aware of than we are, I suppose.
100%. Like, and if you were monitoring, for argument's sake, and you were taking even something like height and weight, like you can look at modifying training. Like if you see that, as you said, if someone is going, like coordination wise is struggling enough, like it's not that hard to modify their training, you know, like take parts of the harder part of training out of it, work more on the skill, the technical aspects, that like without going into all the solutions and some of the ways that we'd work with people at varying levels here, that's some of it. Identifying injuries, like if your players are picking up you know, niggle injuries, so on, that are kind of connected with the likes of ankles, knees, and so on, that, like they're very likely related to growth related you know, parts of growth and so on. Some of this information can be very useful in relation to decision making for coaches too, like even involved in picking teams and so on. Okay, I would say, like, you know, trying to understand a little bit maybe where these players might be at in their stage of development, and that can help a little bit as well, like, for sure.
Yeah, and like it's not that, you know, clubs are going to go out tomorrow and they're not going to pick their big strong, you know, guys that are playing the best at the age group. Of course they are, and that's understandable, and everybody's going to do that. But it's just to probably, like you've mentioned it a couple of times, have a better awareness of those other kids who may be those late developers or late maturers. I think that's just I think it's a really important point. I don't know. I know we're still going to look at these guys tomorrow morning at 14 years of age and saying, Jesus, that guy is, wow, look at him. He's so powerful. He's brilliant. Yeah. He's dominating this. But it's to keep those other guys going, and then obviously to find a challenge for those fellas. And whether it's biobanding and having those guys set a challenge that's at their level, whether they're playing up against the, you know, some of the under 15 guys who are the later matures. I think there's a lot in that could really challenge everybody if you do it properly and put a bit of thought into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think on that you're making, Mike, I suppose a big message is, like, why reward the early maturing player for their, like, as I said, the genetic lottery of being more advanced in their physical attributes? Because we know and we can see that long term it probably does them no favors. Short term it might do them a little bit, but like long term it'll probably do them no favors. So like that's a really important point to make, like that, like why would you allow that? Like, you're probably going to do them a disservice when they get to, you know, their older age groups anyway. Like
a genetic lottery, I like that.
Yeah, well, it is, like, that's what it is, because I mean they've no control over it. And I used to have a nice analogy in one of my presentations around popcorn and the way it develops at different rates and levels. And like every child has their opportunity for the popcorn, or popcorn will pop at its own level, basically. And that's the same with players and so on. So that'll kind of that'll level out as they get a little bit older and so on, for sure. Like,
I saw the popcorn one. Yeah, same heat, same oil, same temperature, and they're all popping at different rates. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and like and that is basically one of the kind of, I suppose, the big messages really there, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Fionn, I'm appreciative of your time, man, and I don't want to delay you much longer. Is there any one point, Fionn, that just to kind of no, it's a hard area to go and encapsulate in a statement, but is there anything there now that we haven't touched on that you think is very important, man, that we maybe highlight before we finish?
Like, to be honest, there's loads. We could be chatting about this for hours, but I mean, that's the general gist of it. I think it's probably important. Like, I had three kind of main targets with this in relation to maybe helping coaches. The number one was to increase awareness at club and kind of county level. And by the way, just to kind of make this point as well, is that this is relevant to a number of different other sports, because more than likely your early and late maturing players that I'm on about here in, say, I'm just looking at Gaelic football, they're also the same guys that are playing soccer and basketball and probably a lot of the other ones. So the likes of athletics is an interesting one as well. So it's relevant to a lot of these sports, like, but just thinking long term, really, I suppose, understanding a little bit about a lot of this, like, is important. But being open minded and patient, like understanding that, you know, that the short term effects here can be, you know, quite sudden and drastic and severe for these players. But ultimately, once they kind of get through this, then it's an awful lot more of a level playing field, then, I suppose, for them. Of course, it's not really a level playing field in those age groups at that given time, and it's not their fault. Yeah. So just kind of keeping that in mind, I suppose, really, like, yeah.
You said you had three things. You had increasing awareness. Did you give me the other two?
The second one was monitoring. So okay. It was actually monitoring, because as much as I've spoken about, like, even at a club level, maybe estimating and understanding a bit more, but if you monitor, if you measure, it's really easy from there. And this is not, you don't need to be an accountant or anything complicated. If anyone wants to reach out to me afterwards, I can most certainly help in that. It's relatively straightforward. And then thirdly would be the practices, and we've kind of touched on some of these. So things like body bending is one example, but like looking at maybe individualizing training, players playing up and down, maybe identifying if players are getting injured quite a bit, or if they're at a kind of a risk, that perspective. So there's a load of different simple, I would say, low hanging fruit that anyone can do without necessarily having to be, you know, have major resources or anything like that.
Yeah, which is obviously going to improve the development of your players, whatever sport that is. It's funny, I have upstairs, I measure the kids there every couple of months just for the crack, really.
Yeah, yeah.
But I put them standing against a door, one of the bedroom door, and I get a little marker and I mark it and I write in the data, whatever. I have to cover it with a coat then, because their mother will kill me if they if they see the mark on the door. But and it's funny, I did it the other day there, and I was looking at them from the last time I measured and where they are now. And it's just something, yeah, I suppose that's it, man. It's an awareness and just to keep a very rough kind of track in it.
That's a real simple, good example, like very, very good example of that. Like, it doesn't have to be anything major at all, but like if you see anything kind of sudden enough there based on what you're doing, and if you're doing it relatively consistently, that's even a red flag for you, like, you know. So yeah, no, anything like that is definitely useful for sure.
Brilliant. Fionn, thanks a million, man. Yeah, it's late. We're actually doing this at nighttime for the people that are listening to try and just catch a break in our schedule. So for the people that are listening again, just a reminder that this is a fundraiser, I suppose, for Recovery Haven in Tralee, the people that provide free cancer support services for the people in Kerry and all around. And again, if you enjoyed some of the content there or last week, you know, I would be very appreciative of a donation of any couple of euros to the fundraising page that's attached to this, and it all goes very much directly to Recovery Haven. So Fionn, thanks a million for your time, man. I found that fascinating, and I'm sure coaches will get a lot out of it too.
Yeah, no problem. And if anyone, like, there's this kind of early enough days in a lot of this research, so if anyone wants to kind of reach out, there's a lot more projects coming later next year from a national perspective, probably, and definitely kind of locally and stuff as well. So I do think that any coaches who just want a little bit more information, I'm actually looking at developing a youth program, athletic development program myself, very much based around maturity levels and so on as well, which I think, so I think there's a lot more that can be kind of teased out over the next while on this. But yeah, thanks again, Mike. And I think, as I said, the idea of linking in with a charity is a nice touch. So hopefully coaches will, they find it useful, they'll contribute a couple of bob.
Brilliant, man. Thanks again for your time, Fionn. Yeah, really appreciate it.
Take it easy, Mike. All right.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.